Good afternoon and welcome to Dialogue. I'm Chrissy Kuiper. Since 2010, Tennessee has had the highest number of hospital closures per population in the nation. The bottom line for more than 25% of Tennessee counties is no hospital, and in many cases, no emergency facilities either. This was the case before the pandemic. The majority of hospital procedures, whether in urban or rural areas, are outpatient and account for most hospital revenue. And COVID hit many hospitals hard because of that impact on outpatient procedures. We have a lot to talk about today. We're discussing rural healthcare, and we have a big panel to discuss it all with. So let's get underway. Would you all please introduce yourselves and tell us a little about your organization and what you do? Judy, would you start?
My name is Judy Reutman. I'm the executive director of the Tennessee Healthcare Campaign. For 30 years, the Tennessee Healthcare Campaign has worked for affordable, equitable access to quality healthcare for Tennesseans. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. And in the last couple of years, we've taken a real look at rural hospital closures.
Tina.
Good afternoon. I'm Tina Pilgreen, and I'm the director for the State Office of Rural Health at Tennessee Department of Health. And we work with hospitals and clinics across the state to increase funding for uninsured adults in Tennessee, as well as we work with provider recruitment and repayment for providers working in the state as far as their loan repayment for school to increase that recruitment and increase providers across the state in those rural areas.
Excellent. Chanda.
All right. I'm Chanda Freeman with the Tennessee Justice Center. Tennessee Justice Center is a 25-year-old nonprofit, nonpartisan law firm and public advocacy center. We have been focused on advocating for good healthcare policies, most recently Medicaid expansion. And we are focused around nutrition, health equity and justice, and advocacy. So we're happy to be on the panel today.
It's good to have you. Thank you for being here. Bill.
Good afternoon. This is Bill Jolly. I'm the Senior Vice President at the Tennessee Hospital Association. And we're actually the advocacy organization for the hospitals and health systems here in Tennessee. I work primarily with the small rural hospital constituency section. So I represent about 65 of our 145 or so hospitals throughout the state and really work with them to assist in delivering accessible, cost-effective, quality healthcare services within those hospital systems. And also manage the Tennessee Center for Health Workforce Development, which is a subsidiary of THA. We actually provide incentives to look at recruiting primary care providers to the rural and underserved areas of the state. Good morning.
Excellent. JC.
Good afternoon. I'm JC Worrell, Executive Director of Rural Health Association of Tennessee. We are a nonprofit organization, but also unique in that we're a membership-based organization. So our members are school health directors, rural hospitals, clinics, and other community-based organizations that all want to work together to improve the health of rural Tennesseans.
Logan.
Yes, my name is Logan McCoy. I am a special projects director at the Tennessee Department of Economic and Community Development. We are one of the smaller state agencies in state government. We have about 100 employees across the state, and we primarily focus on industry expansion, job recruitment, and also rural development. And my focus is on the rural development team. And I've worked with Bill and JC in the past on the Rural Hospital Transformation Program.
And Carol.
Good afternoon. I'm Carol Myers. I'm a professor at the University of Tennessee in the College of Nursing, and I primarily focus on health policy, specifically access to care with a special fondness for rural areas and looking at healthcare reform both at the national and the state level. Thanks for inviting me today.
I'm really glad to have all of you. This is such a comprehensive group, so I'm sure you'll be able to answer all my questions. One term that I do want us to define before we get started, because it's already come up in preliminary discussions before the show started, and I'm very unclear on what it is and how it works, and it definitely has to do with this whole question of rural healthcare. So what is the certificate of need? Who wants to define that for me? Anybody? Okay. I guess we'll talk about that later.
I was hoping someone else would answer, because I will botch it. But the certificate of need basically is a process that communities go to make any changes locally in the healthcare services that are provided. So if there is, if a hospital or a clinic, I think even maybe independent providers want to open new services, there's a process to go through to get approval for that. And ideally the community would be involved in those processes as well.
Okay. So that has to happen.
Chrissy,
yes, go ahead.
I'll just add a little bit, you know, it has strong historical roots. The original intention of the certificate of need process was for planning, to look at the appropriate complement of services and to look at how to best offer services in communities. I'm sure among this group, opinions would be very mixed as to how effective it's been in health planning, but it is a process that you must go through for new programs and new facilities, and it's run at the state level.
But every community, every time a hospital or a clinic or somebody new wants to come in and provide health services, there has to be a CON?
I think you're directing that question at me, and I'm a little reluctant to answer it because I don't know what's included and what's not included. Someone else may be able to answer that.
This is Bill, and I don't know that I could give a comprehensive response, but I'd say it traditionally would deal more with higher levels of care. So the creation of a new hospital, as an example, it wouldn't necessarily apply to the establishment of a clinic per se, like a federally qualified health center or a rural health clinic. Those are governed a little differently. But if you did have, as an example, a hospital close and a new entity had, you know, the intent to reopen that facility, they would have to go through the process of submitting a certificate of need and having that reviewed at the state level, as Carol has stated.
Okay. And that's reviewed by the Department of Health?
It is reviewed by the Health Services and Development Agency, which is an entity within state government.
Okay.
And there are public open hearings for those as well.
In the community or at the state level?
At the state level, but oftentimes I've been to those hearings, and it's always amazing to see when local community members go to, address how whatever the change is could potentially impact them locally.
Mm. Can you each speak to what you feel from where you're sitting? What does rural healthcare in Tennessee look like right now? Tina, actually, would you start us off? I know you're kind of new in the Office of Rural Health, and that makes you perfect to start us off because you have a very brand new perspective on what's happening.
Yes, Chrissy. Yes, I am new, and I was talking with the panel earlier. You know, I came from Arkansas and from the Arkansas Department of Health, and that's been a somewhat of a benefit just because the rural healthcare, the landscape looks very similar to what I experienced, you know, in Arkansas. But, you know, for the most part, we've already mentioned the critical access hospitals, our small hospitals that are closing, that continues to, you know, to be a problem, which in result leads to, you know, further problems related to the residents of Tennessee. We know and we've seen that if you do not have that access to care conveniently located, oftentimes you won't seek it out, you know, or you may not have the transportation to, you know, to get to that facility. So, you know, which then in turn leads to a domino effect and leads to more problems. So, you know, I think the health professional shortage areas, you know, 91 out of 95 counties have, you know, health professional shortage areas. So, you know, what we do at the State Office of Rural Health is really try to look at those gaps in services and, you know, try to meet some of those needs through our clinics and our community faith-based clinics and look at establishing more community health workers and really anything that we can do to help meet those gaps, you know, for those communities so they can still try to seek out those services close to home. So, you know, I think that's the biggest thing is, you know, making sure that that care is convenient and is accessible to all residents, specifically the rural residents of Tennessee.
We'll come back to that too, because there, I mean, we got to figure out what is there, a, you know, is there a plan for improving it? Because clearly the Office of Rural Health has its work cut out for it. There's
absolutely
too many counties that just don't have the care. Yeah.
Right. And absolutely. And, you know, those small hospitals do meet, you know, a lot of those needs. And so when they close, again, I mentioned, you know, that's that leaves residents with, you know, not a lot of access to services. And so, you know, we are doing a lot of things looking at not only increasing funding, but really trying to match those areas of need and working with our partners to bridge those gaps, if you will. Mm. And we work closely with JC and with, you know, with Bill and with a lot of partners across the state, because we all know it takes a team for sure.
Logan, for you, this is an economic development issue. And, you know, for counties that have no or little health care, no emergency services, no hospital, how does that translate into a lack of development for the community?
Yeah, I think it's the chicken or the egg situation. In rural areas, predominantly, the population has been declining, and we call that the brain drain. It's your millennials and your Gen X's that are growing up and then going to college and typically staying in an urban setting post-graduation. And is that because that there aren't opportunities locally that they are interested in for employment? Possibly. And because of that, we've seen that a lot of times it's difficult to recruit industry to rural communities because of the access to a quality and available workforce. It's a workforce development problem for manufacturers as it is, I'm sure, with healthcare providers in the hospital setting. It's a pretty big problem statewide. And so from an employer's perspective, we obviously hear that access to high quality and affordable healthcare locally is paramount for their employees. But as far as the employer's perspective and making sure that their employees have that, that's not necessarily the employer's position. It's also something that they put on the employee to decide where they want to seek high quality and affordable health care. And what we're finding is, quite frankly, is a lot of people are driving for services that could essentially be offered in their local community. It just may not be known that services is actually being provided locally.
Okay. Carol.
Yeah, I really liked when Logan said a chicken and an egg, because you've talked about how a challenge it is to do economic development in the rural counties, particularly when there's a lack of infrastructure like a hospital. But the reverse is true. The disparities, the deficiencies we see in health in rural residents are not just because of the lack of healthcare, therefore the lack of things that contribute to health. And economics is number one. So economically distressed counties are where we often see the most unhealthy people. So there's this reciprocal intertwined relationship that is so important. So a hospital provides healthcare, and that's about 20% of what contributes to health, but also is an economic engine, and economics contribute about 40% to health. So it isn't one thing that's going to solve the challenges. No. In the deficiencies and that we see in rural areas. So Logan, I really appreciated your chicken and egg analogy. Thank you.
Chanda, from your perspective, what makes this a social justice issue?
Well, I think it's a social justice issue when we look at the numbers of the people who are left without access to health insurance. When we look at the disparities that are happening between people of color in these health outcomes, there was already disparities when we look at the social determinants of health, and we look at all of these health outcomes, we look at educational outcomes, and like Carol and Logan mentioned earlier, all of these things are tied, these economics are tied directly to these health outcomes. So when we look at across the state who the folks are who are being most impacted right now by COVID, you know, it's these same folks who are most often having these poor health outcomes in the state. So I think that there's no way for us just to focus on, you know, hospital closures and not really focus on those root causes of things that are contributing to the health outcomes that we're seeing across the state.
Right. There's so many interconnected parts of this. I mean, it's not just the economics, it's infrastructure. And then infrastructure influences the economics. And then you have the healthcare disparities and the hospitals and the lack of, or there's a lot of. What's the difference from your viewpoint, just to take a tangent for a moment, any of you, the differences really between, are the marketplaces different in every single county? Is there a real difference in marketplace when you're talking about an urban place as opposed to a rural place? Does it just have to do with access to insurance?
I'll take this. Mm-hmm. You know, whenever I have opportunity to go out and talk about rural health versus urban health and what it looks like, I always like to tell a tale of two cities and to look at maybe Williamson County, which is Franklin, which is one of the counties that have the better health outcomes across the state, and compare it to what we see happening in Lake County, mm-hmm. which is in the northwest corner of Tennessee. Yeah. And in Lake County, the employer, the person that employs the most people, are at the prison. There is no grocery store in the entire county. Transportation is a huge barrier for most folks. This is one of the counties that does not have a pediatrician, nor do they have cardiologists. The nearest hospital is about 45 minutes away. And if we, you know, they say we're comparing apples and oranges, but if we look at these same opportunities in like a Williamson County, where they have a substantial number of medical providers in the area, they have a significantly smaller problem with transportation. It's just a formula for like night and day health outcomes for folks that live in these two places.
Yeah. Bill, from your viewpoint, what is rural health looking like right now? I mean, you work with a lot of hospitals and providers, so what do they say?
Well, yeah, and I do agree. I think access is definitely a contributor to the challenges that we're seeing in a lot of the rural communities across the state. I mean, honestly, we've been waving the flag for years about the vulnerability in rural hospitals, and the pandemic has really exposed those gaps in the system. So, you know, given we now have over 20% of our communities that do not have access to a community-based facility, I think, you know, the future is going to rely on the ability to innovate, to look at redefining how healthcare is actually being delivered, looking at new, you know, payment models for making sure that our rural providers are being adequately reimbursed. But I think, you know, certainly prior to the pandemic, the crisis, you know, had already existed. And I think looking into the future as hospitals look at the possibility of repaying some of the provider relief funds and so forth, I mean, we could really revert back to, you know, even greater challenges for the future and making sure that our hospitals remain financially viable and, more importantly, maintaining a medical presence in these communities.
Judy and JC. Judy, go ahead.
So I just wanted to raise up the perspective of the patients. When COVID hit, it did not hit a level playing field as far as rural communities. They were already more likely to have high numbers of people with chronic illnesses. The communities of color were already very underserved. And so when you bring in COVID and then, you know, people already have asthma or you know, underlying illnesses, that's not going to be a good outcome. When we try to encourage vaccination and people have no insurance, have no relationship with a provider that would encourage vaccination, those problems are even more than they were before. So we already had issues, and then COVID just really brought those to the fore. I'm hopeful that COVID has taught everyone that we're all in this together. And it does not, even those of us who have insurance do not benefit if the other people in our community don't have insurance, don't have any way to get care,
right.
Then the whole community is likely to be sicker. So I'm hoping that awareness has improved things and that people are willing to take some new looks at rural healthcare.
We can hope. I'm hopeful.
Absolutely.
JC, from your viewpoint, what is it looking like out there?
For me, in hearing this conversation and when I talk to people locally in rural communities, I think and you asked about what does the market look like from place to place? And so, first of all, you know, the number one predictor of health is a person's zip code. And that really determines, you know, the level of income in the community and the things that have already been mentioned. But I also see just how patchworked our healthcare system is. And so no rural community is the same. Some might have a charitable clinic, some may not. Some may have a federally qualified health center, some may not. Some may have a hospital or a freestanding ER, and some may not. And then two, we haven't talked about, you know, dental services, mental health services either. So, you know, you've just, the disparity of what is available to people and just the way that our healthcare system has been patched together, I think is our biggest challenge because it is so different county to county, there is no single solution,
right.
That makes it a challenge also.
Right. Let's take a real quick break, and then we will be back with more discussion about rural healthcare in Tennessee on Dialogue. This is WUOT. Welcome back to Dialogue. Today's topic is rural healthcare. Before the break, JC was saying, got a real patchwork system. No county is the same. Every county is different. You have providers who are private. You have providers who are public. Let's talk about the providers for a second, because part of the problem with rural hospital closures is revenue. They either cannot stay open because they have so many underinsured or uninsured patients, or, you know, the population just doesn't support the hospital. What are the incentives for providers, even if they're small, to move into any community, especially a rural community that has a population that, you know, is chronically ill and underinsured? I I'll leave that open to anybody who has an answer.
You know, people love living in rural communities. I love East Tennessee. I think it's one of the most beautiful places in the world. But it is challenging to get providers. And one of the frustrating things is that it doesn't have to be this way. And people, you know, in Kentucky, where there's Medicaid expansion, the hospitals are doing much better. So for those communities on the border, that's frustrating.
Okay. That's the first mention of Medicaid expansion so far. We'll talk about that more. Hopefully we'll have time.
Chrissy, I'll add, Bill and Tina could probably speak better to some of the actual incentives, but when we're talking workforce shortages in rural areas, we're not only talking about specialty providers and primary care physicians. The allied health professionals, some of those entry-level health professions, are also a real challenge to recruit and to retain. And so, we need to do more to help build a pipeline of individuals and introduce them to careers in healthcare. So with Rural Health Association of Tennessee, we've launched an apprenticeship program.
Oh, JC, you're frozen. We'll get back to you. Carol. Go ahead, JC.
And
you cut out in the middle of your of what you were talking about, though. So your recruitment, the program.
Okay. So basically, you know, introducing more people to healthcare professions, period, is needed. And then the hope is that once they get their foot in the door into healthcare, they have opportunities to advance up that career ladder. And I think we need more programs that really help people do that, because a lot of people don't know that how many opportunities there are within healthcare. It's not just being a doctor, nurse, or dentist. There are a multitude of positions that make really good careers and are needed.
Can you give us an example of some of those careers? Are you talking about administrative positions?
Yeah, anything okay. to do. Well, and I mentioned the dental assistants and dentists, people that can make dentures, people that can take x-rays, behavioral health aides, community health workers has been mentioned before too. And getting started in those positions can oftentimes lead to higher level positions. Medical coding is something that I was talking to a system that is coming into some rural areas in West Tennessee, and they were just talking about the need for people that know how to code things specific to rural communities and critical access hospitals. Even, you know, maintenance and technology and medical records, there are a lot of jobs in healthcare that I think that people don't really think about.
Yeah.
This is Bill. If I could build upon that, there mm-hmm. are a number of amazing programs that are available within Tennessee, both through the State Office of Rural Health, also through the Tennessee Center for Health Workforce Development. So we're able to actually provide incentives to residents that are in training, primary care residents. They actually receive those incentives while they're training in our medical schools throughout the state. And then in return for the incentives we provide, they actually have an obligation to serve in a rural and underserved area of the state. But through our review process, one of the things that we do look for that has really led to some great retention rates is typically those providers have some connection to rural. So maybe they were born and raised there. They may have married someone that's from a rural community. So oftentimes the providers that we do provide in partnership with our medical schools, they actually stay there beyond their commitment time to our organization. And that program has worked extremely well. And as JC alluded to, we need greater investments in programs that do incentivize those that are in training to locate to the rural areas of the state.
Are those programs grant funded? Are they state funded? How are they funded?
So not to get into a comprehensive overview of actually how that program works, but we do have a partnership with the Bureau of Teen Care, and we do partner with four of our five medical schools in the state through a contractual agreement where we help subsidize those incentives through those partnerships.
Thank you. Carol.
Yeah, I'd like to add on to the comments, the great comments that have been made by Judy, JC, and Bill, but look at it from a different perspective. I think we need to look at rural communities differently. We don't need to use the model of what works in an urban area for a rural area. They are categorically different. And furthermore, we don't need to look at what we've always done. And let me give a couple of examples. Rightly so, there's a lot of focus on hospital closures. I am not convinced that reopening that hospital is the best and most sustainable approach. And I'm going to give a couple reasons why I say something like that. I think we need to look at new delivery systems and how they line up with what's unique about rural places and rural people. One of my graduate students recently interviewed folks in a community where the hospital closed, and people saw their primary care as going away because they equated healthcare with hospitals. We could do better with less money to also look at providing primary care and prevention services, and then looking at alternative models like freestanding emergency rooms, extended use of telehealth, alliances with tertiary medical centers in the urban areas. So we need to look at things differently and to look at some of the strategies that I'm encouraged to hear, like Bill. How do we get rural healthcare providers that are committed to rural living? That's important. And having roots in those communities is the number one predictor of retention of rural providers in rural communities. I think we also need to look at all of the resources that we have. JC's mentioned, let's just not focus on physician providers. Let's consider the whole health professional team. Of course, I would advocate for nurses in that regard. But rather than being a provider-driven system, we should be a patient-driven system. And what do the patients need? And that need changes over time. So we need to look at things differently from a rural perspective, and we need to be bold enough to do things differently than we've done before.
And it sounds like every community has to also be involved and figure out what that answer is for their community.
And that involves, oh, Christian, I'm so glad you said that, because that involves another point. We tend to talk about deficits in rural communities. We need to focus on the assets in rural communities. That gets lost. The strength of the community is the secret, I think.
Yeah, Jason, go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to say that I wholeheartedly agree with that. We absolutely need to be looking at patient-centered models and what some new ways. We can't keep doing as we have done to really serve the needs of the people. I think that in the conversation of rural hospital closures, and even knowing that the solutions are going to look different in the past, and it may not be a matter of reopening a facility, I think from my perspective and conversations that I've had, the local community still wants to and need to be involved in what that looks like. And I think that is really the key there, that, you know, local still always going to be better. A local community knows what they need better than any other outside entity. So it's just a matter of making sure that they're educated, that they have opportunities to have these kinds of conversations. You know, I've been to communities where they just kind of looked at every granular detail. What can we do to stay open? But they looked at it from the standpoint of our patients. costs, right? What do our patients need? How many emergencies do we have? What if we did this? Or how long for maternal care, obstetrics, what does that need in our community? And looking at it from where the community needs are and then building from there.
Chrissy, I would add one thing to what JC said, is there still are policy levers that we can pull, and in deference to our two representatives from state government and then from federal officials, we do need to look at alternative reimbursement models. Mm-hmm. We do need to look at Medicaid expansion. I'm with Judy. I can't miss an opportunity, because we know what the experiences has been in rural states that have expanded Medicaid. So we have opportunities. And then I think, and Logan, this is directly for you, I think if we approach the issue of rural economic development and healthcare in an integrated fashion, we will be better stewards of the resources of our state, as well as more responsive to our communities.
I'd like to follow what Carol mentioned. I think what we do whenever we're encountering with a rural county mayor, I think it comes down to education too. We hear from them that they campaign on jobs, 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 but a lot of time they don't make the correlation between health and economic development. And it's just an easier campaign slogan, I believe, to run on jobs and working with the private sector and a manufacturer, and you do the ribbon cutting if you have a 100 job employer come to town, and that's all fun and great. But it really is an education component too, where working with local leadership, not just the elected officials, but everyone locally. And we do that quite a bit in our rural development team when it comes to our various grants for infrastructure or our grants for the Main Street redevelopment, various grants that we have at our agency. But it really is a locally driven collaborative effort all the way up to the state level.
Tina, there was something you wanted to say.
Oh, I agree with Logan. And, you know, something that we've really been, and I've been specifically looking at since my short term here, has been really looking at ways to diversify our services. And the reason I say that is because, like we all mentioned, it is not a cookie cutter approach, and every community is different. And looking at those social determinants of health, to me, are key in everything that we do. Because you cannot fix the problem if you don't fix the structure. And so, you know, we've been talking about, you know, working with our community health councils, community health workers, because it is about trust. And I think the reason that a lot of residents do, you know, feel a loss when community hospitals close is because that's who they trust. But if you can find those other options for them, through whether it's through a faith-based clinic or whether it's through, you know, another type of program, then I think that's key. And so we've really done, I think, a good job, and will continue to look at ways that we can diversify our services. For instance, Project Access is care coordination. So, you know, they're not right there in the community, but what they do is they walk that patient through exactly what they need. And they basically hold their hand, if they will, to make sure that they get the specialty care that they need. And I was actually in a meeting last week and with one of our Project Access, and they were doing a presentation, and I was asking them about retention and patient follow-up. And I said, you know, because we all know a lot of times patients may not, if they can't get to the hospital, or they may not make it to appointments for this, you know, other reasons. And they have a 95%, you know, rate of, I mean, that's how many patients show up for their appointments when they work through care coordination services. And I said, you know, I attribute that to, it's the trust, it's the follow through, it's making sure that they are meeting their needs. They find out if they need transportation. You know, they work with them to find those, to meet those, again, those social determinants of health. And so it's been successful, but that's just one type of service. You know, community faith-based clinics meet the needs in other communities. Critical access hospitals may meet the need in another community. So I really do think it's about diversifying the services.
And I guess, I mean, is Project Access available to patients who don't have insurance?
Yes, yes. It's okay. Part of the safety net. funding that does is specifically for the uninsured adults 19 to 64. So, okay. Yes.
Two things that I definitely want to touch on before we end, because as I said before the show started, we're running out of time. Telehealth. Telehealth has expanded exponentially since the beginning of the pandemic. And I'm wondering if, from your viewpoints, if it has improved things in our rural counties and communities at all, as far as access to some healthcare.
I'll take that one. The short answer I would say is yes. Absolutely. There are instances where someone's able to get service that means that they didn't have to take off from work, find childcare, drive a certain distance if there's not a local, you know, a nearby provider. I would also say yes in the area of mental health services because there's so much stigma that surrounds mental health that it's an opportunity to connect with somebody in, you know, connect with a professional that can help with a need in a more, you know, a way where someone local is not going to see your truck parked at the local counselor's office and, you know, the word get out and ask people having to ask, you know, oh, so saw so-and-so's truck. So in that respect, I think, yes, obviously, you know, there are some situations we've heard, and I don't want to steer us off topic, but, you know, there are some situations where counselors have said they don't know a person's the only person in the room. And so I think there are some sensitivities that we have to work through and some, you know, telehealth is not going to be the silver bullet solution for a lot of health issues, but it has definitely helped.
Sure.
Yeah. May I add to that? This is something that I study and work on a lot. Telehealth policy in the state is it has not only exponentially increased in use of telehealth, it's also been a good equalizer, particularly for people in rural areas. But I need to remind everybody that currently we are working under temporary executive orders that changed how telehealth is delivered. And now you can have a telehealth service from your home, where previously it was most commonly from one provider's office to another provider's office. So it was mediated. And when that executive order goes away, a significant portion of our growth will go away. And I think we need to be looking at that as from a state perspective. In addition, the governor did call a special session during the pandemic for which we have favorable, really just being equal reimbursement for telehealth services. But because that was a special session, that law is only in effect for, well, it was 2 years at the time of the enactment. So we need as a state to proactively look at how do we continue to support telehealth and do it in the right way. We do have some lessons learned and not everyone has access because of broadband, but definitely telehealth is a game changer.
Yeah, Logan.
Yeah, I would love to put a plug here on broadband. Obviously, to have a telehealth visit, the backbone is broadband. And yeah. Thankfully, under Governor Haslam and now Governor Lee, through our agency at the Department of Economic Development, we have a grant program that will allow for increased broadband expansion. And the grants go to the providers themselves, the actual internet service providers, if it's your electric co-op or your telephone co-op, to actually build the physical infrastructure, the poles and the fiber itself. And so I think Governor Lee this past session included $100 million for broadband, and it's gonna just continue to be more and more in funding, similar to TVA back in the day with electric power.
Let me add emphasis to what Logan's just said. You've heard reference from almost every speaker about social determinants or drivers of health. There is one determinant or driver that's been designated by the American Public Health Association as a super determinant of health, and that's broadband access because of its impact on economic development, education, healthcare, et cetera. So it touches all the drivers. So yes, broadband is something that we need to continue to prioritize our state is pretty good in this regard around telehealth.
And it's, I mean, and it's getting better. Yeah.
Yeah, this is Bill. I know there's some expectation that broadband support may be a component of the infrastructure bill that's now being debated and discussed in conference or in Congress. So, you know, we made some significant investments here in Tennessee, but the hope is there's going to be additional support provided at the federal level.
Well, let's, I mean, that was one of the things I wanted to touch on was CARES Act funding and extra funding that's pouring into states from the federal government at the moment that is being used for healthcare and expanding healthcare. But eventually, of course, that's going to end. So I'm wondering from the state level if there is talk, you know, the Medicaid expansion stuff is very mixed. It seems like every time the discussion comes around again in the legislature, there are more people who were not signed on to begin with who, you know, are kind of in favor of it. But it's always, it's never, you know, it's never a done deal. So I'm wondering what other funding there is from the state that we can count on that can help us see some of these recommendations through, not just broadband, but telehealth expansion as a whole, not just, you know, providers, as we've said, but these incentives for people to get involved in these other healthcare careers that are not just about nursing and being doctors. Anybody want to speak to that, especially from our state offices?
I mean, I'll just briefly plug that I think Governor Lee has done a lot with focusing on vocational education and the community colleges and your TCATs across the state, which typically do provide those certificate programs for LPNs and various other business office type staff. So there's going to be increased funding for those programs as well as Tennessee Promise. There's a backload of people that are applying for that and Tennessee Reconnect. And I believe that was included in the budget this year to essentially eliminate the wait list for that program.
Judy, yeah.
I just wanted to raise up that the American Rescue Plan offers Tennessee $900 million to expand Medicaid. That would be enough to cover the program for the next 6 years. And I do think that that extra money may be changing the equation at the state level. There's also some federal talk in the reconciliation plan that's being currently discussed about Medicaid expansion and Medicare expansion. So those are possibilities from a federal funding point of view.
And there's also about $8.5 billion that's still available through the American Rescue Plan for rural providers. And there's no expectation that those dollars will be allocated to various programs later in the year.
Well, we just have a couple of minutes. So any last words, next steps? Yeah, JC.
Yeah, there are two things that I wanted to chime in on before we left. First of all, I didn't want to leave Judy and Carol and Chanda out on a limb on the Medicaid expansion piece. I think that that is something that I've consistently heard from local communities that addressing our state's uninsured population is important. And, you know, they've shared some different funding outside of that that's available and maybe some opportunities. Another thing that Carol mentioned earlier, I just wanted to come back to, I think it kind of relates to funding. I don't think that we can always throw more money at an issue and expect it to be resolved. I think looking at our assets in rural communities and looking at what's going right in rural communities and learning from those communities that are doing exceptionally good things is also an important part of addressing all of the needs that we've talked about today. And I just want to give a shout out to the Center for Rural Health Research based at ETSU. Michael Meat there does a lot of talking about rural strengths and assets. And so that, I think that would be of interest to many of your listeners as well.
I will make sure that link is on our website. I want to thank all of you for participating today. I know this is a big topic, and of course we didn't cover everything that of course could be covered, but it does begin the conversation, so maybe we'll revisit this in some time and talk about it again, especially as time goes by and we see what happens as case counts rise again. And you never know. I mean, communities may change what they want and try to figure that out on their own. We heard from Judy Reutemann, Tina Pilgreen, Carol Myers, Chanda Freeman, Bill Jolly, J.C. Werrell, and Logan McCoy. I'm Chrissy Kuiper. I thank Greg Hill for production today. And if all of my guests would hang out, please, on Zoom for a minute so that we can say a proper goodbye after everybody's done. Thank you, all of you listeners, for listening. This episode will be on our website, wuot.org, in just a bit. Dialogue is a production of WUOT News, and we are listener-supported public radio at the University of Tennessee. Thank you so much for joining us today.